Films on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Screen Talk, even though Al Sting said...
Should we do it again?
Dan? Okay.
Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
There you go, that's more like it. Welcome to Dan Clark Talks Films. That's my producer there, Adam. He realised his mistake and, like the professional he is, he just stopped and started again. It was amazing. So welcome to the show. For those of you that have are first-time listeners, this show is a show where we discuss all things film and television. We have producers, writers, directors, comedians, critics, composers, anyone involved. Basically, we are whores and we'll accept anyone into our booth. First of all, what the fuck is going on with the weather? The weather, this is really bothering me. Not just that it's cold, but I can't wear my mid-season clothes yet. I really want to wear a light jacket and a silk scarf, and it's still woolly scarf and puffer jacket weather. It's really, really depressing me. I don't understand what's going on. We have an amazing show, which will warm us up. We have two brilliant guests today. We have the TV critic. I don't know his official title. Is it TV editor, TV critic from Heat Magazine, and general expert on television, Boyd Hilton, and the wonderful actor-writer Jim Howick, who will be defending his guilty pleasure later in the show. But to kickstart the show, we do this every week. We pick songs or piece of score from films. Stuff we like. This is a song that I do actually like. I wouldn't have picked this if it wasn't for what I'm about to discuss with Jim. But I like this song anyway. It's kind of one of my favourite Bond songs. This is Duran Duran with A View to a Kill.
Chance to die, but can we dance
Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
I would actually say that is definitely in my top three Bond song. But you Bond songs, you Boyd, we have Boyd Hilton here with us. Hello,
Hi,
Boyd.
Dan.
You slightly turned your nose up when I said that.
Yeah, top three, no. Yeah. I mean, top ten.
All right, top.
Maybe.
Top four. Go on, what's your top three? Go.
Nobody Does It Better got to be number one.
Okay.
Goldfinger, Live and Let Die.
These are all obvious
these are all
choices.
Better. Moonraker. All right, Moonraker, underrated. Okay. Just loads better than that. I mean, I love Duran Duran, don't get me wrong.
I think the thing that lets it down are all the weird orchestra hits.
Yes, do you remember very those? Dated.
Yeah,
very
do you remember
dated.
When you used to get a Casio keyboard
completely.
And hit those?
Well, I didn't, but you did, yeah. But I love that sound when it was in the 80s.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was in...
Back then it was good.
Back then it was good, but now it sounds terrible.
Yeah, I think if you removed all that and stripped it down to its basics, that's
right.
A good song.
We'll get them to re-record it, and then it would be in my top three.
Okay.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a Bond song then.
That's true.
I'm going to have Moonraker at my funeral.
What about anyone who says, you know you're a hipster when you say my favourite Bond theme is the Radiohead one that didn't make it into
being a bit of a tosser,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly, yeah,
because it's not. I wonder if they actually felt any genuine rejection.
I think they probably must have done. Even they must have felt rejected. Because they was literally rejected.
Yeah.
So yeah, surely.
And then publicly known.
Yeah. I don't think they would have put it out, in fact, if they hadn't felt rejected, because that was a kind of interesting.
Was that like a bit of sweet revenge,
do you think? Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I mean, it was never going to be a
No, it wasn't, exactly.
It was so everyone's depressed at the beginning of the film, although maybe it would have added something to Spectre that it needed. But I can't believe Sam Smith won an Oscar for that song. I'm not going to sit here and slate Sam Smith, but... it was the second song that had a familiar motif from an already existing song.
It was extraordinary, because it's such a dirge of a song. I mean, I think it worked with the title sequence. Worked at least better than it does just listening to the song. Because I love I think the title sequence is beautiful of Spectre.
Yeah.
But as a song on its own, it was terrible. But I predicted he would win the Oscar, by the way, because he won the Golden Globe. And I thought, maybe he's going to do it. And he did give us one of the great ridiculous speeches of all time. So, it was worth it.
Did you? Were people genuinely... there was this sort of notion that people were offended by him saying he was the first gay man to win an Oscar.
Yeah, I don't think anyone was offended. Well, I wasn't. I think it was just kind of hilarious that he thought he was without even thinking about it. Just kind of, I'm
just going to make up a fact.
Yeah.
In front of
60
many?
Million. Yeah. Well, about in America, I think about 40, 50 million people watch it. And around the way they say billion, who knows? But
well, probably 30 million of those would believe him.
Exactly, that's true. Yeah,
they'd be like, what, gay people are allowed to win Oscars?
Yeah.
That's a hideous generalisation. Boyd Hill. You are. What is... I forget your actual...
My title.
Title, yeah.
It's a bit ridiculous. It's now Entertainment Director of Heat Magazine. Yeah, I'm director. If you, because I've been there so long, you become a director if you've been there.
You've been there since it began,
Oh,
right?
My God, yeah. 17 years.
Oh, my...
Yeah, literally embarrassing.
You know when they say, people, like parents especially say it to kids now, there's no such thing as a job for life. Well, you're proving that's wrong.
Yeah, that's my sole purpose.
How have
to try
you done
prove that?
That?
I think, because I don't know, they just can't get rid of me. I'm just, it would be quite expensive to get rid of me probably now.
Really?
And, I bring in some kind of worth to the magazine. It is bizarre, yeah. I mean, it's a magazine for 30-year-olds, yeah. I mean, yeah, but it's incredible.
Obviously, you do a lot of other things. You do Q&As. And do you write for other publications?
Every now and then,
well?
Not a lot. Every now and then from The Observer or Guardian or something. Not many other people, actually. I'm trying to think about it. Yeah, that's about it. Yeah.
And in a world of where they say that print is dead, how does Heat survive in this day and age?
Well, if it's not dead, it's definitely... definitely on a decline.
It's
on
in
a
Florida, lying in the sun.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I think it's boring, but what newspapers did, the newspapers are absolutely on their way out print-wise because they put all their stuff on the internet for free, like The Guardian did that, it's kind of currently losing millions and millions every week.
Yeah.
But magazines like ours, we always separate, so we've got a new website, but the magazine isn't on the web, so you have to buy it if you want to read the glorious stuff that I come up with, for example. It's not on the internet. So I think that just about keeps it going, that people do, we have enough people, thankfully, that buy it, we can make out to read whatever we put on
and a reasonable price.
Yeah, $165.
I mean, I go into news agents, especially in London's trendy Soho, and you see all these kind of prestige magazines that cost like 12 it's quid.
Oh, do you know what? I do write for some of them. Yeah, I've written for GQ Style and right. Yeah, some of those magazines. Yeah, those really lavish,
yeah,
particularly fashion magazines. Yeah, they are incredible. But they, I don't understand the how they. But it's all advertising. They get like hundreds of pages of advertising. Yeah, I did a cover story for GQ Style. Actually, that was one of the high points of my career with the guy who stars in the last Star Wars film. John Boyega, who was wonderful, and I did a 6-page interview with him.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
And was he nice?
He was lovely, absolutely lovely. He's incredible. Yeah,
he seems to be loving his moment in the sun, doesn't he? I like that he's...
he's embracing it.
Yeah, but in a good way, not in a sort of arrogant way.
Yeah.
so I guess, you know, this does lead us neatly into what I wanted to talk to you about, which is how things are changing so much, obviously in the print media and social media. But... I'm interested in like the state of comedy at the moment and whether we are in a good place, a bad place, a transitional place. What is your feeling?
Yeah, it's interesting. Do you mean on TV and on film, not television?
Television
particularly.
Yeah. But even film as well. I don't feel like there are classic comedies being released in the film world either. But
no,
you know.
I think in TV, I think in film you're right. You know, I think there's a real. I think in film it's part of the victim of this whole thing about films now are either huge $200 million blockbusters or they're $5 million indie things that are shot
or less,
video
even.
Or even less. Yeah. And the middle ground of the kind of 40-50 million, because kind of any decent film these days costs pretty much at least that if you're going to get a recognised cast. So it's hard to do like your Groundhog Day type of film, and that just off the top of my head.
Good reference.
Yeah, it's a brilliant film. But yeah, just that middle level of film is really hard to make. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I saw a comedy last night actually, which is Mother's Day, which has got one of these all star casts. Yeah. You know, Valentine's Day, New Year's Day things. And that you can get off the ground because it's got Julia Roberts and Jennifer Aniston, Jack Whitehall's in it, incredibly.
Wow.
Yeah, because it's got all these stars, and it's very glossy, but it's just hard to do. And you know, I guess Judd Apatow, he's doing great comedies, pretty much. I think at least interesting ones that are too long. but he's getting he gets finance for those films. But Woody Allen, of course. I know you talked about Woody with Stephen Merchant, that brilliant podcast. But yeah, it's hard, I think. If you want to get a pretty well-made, relatively expensive comedy, it's hard to get it made. TV, I think it's all about... I think BBC has been not making enough comedy. That's my kind of...
Well, I'm going to come on to that, because...
Yes, but everyone else, I think Channel 4 is doing pretty well, I think. You know, Catastrophe they've had Raised by Wolves, the Caitlin Moran thing. They've got Flowers, which is on...
Yeah, it's on this
now,
week.
This week, which is really interesting.
We're hoping to get Will in soon.
What an incredible story that is, yeah. So I think they're after a period where they had a pretty bad time, I think, with comedy, they're doing pretty well. But I think the BBC needs to do more. I don't know why they haven't done more, particularly on BBC One. You hardly ever get a comedy on BBC One. It's really difficult. BBC's are not so bad. Yeah.
I would actually say that your theory, which I think is in the business people kind of are familiar with, this idea of the really big film and the small film, actually applies in this country anyway to TV comedy as well, not to drama, because it seems to me that BBC One's the only place that they're really that they launch big shows, and they're they're trying to replicate the success of Mrs. Brown's Boys, Miranda. They want those really big, broad mainstream shows. Or you have Channel 4, which are making brilliant shows, like stuff that I like. Yes. You know, I'm aware that I have a taste.
Yes,
but they're small in terms of viewing figures.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, they're great. Yep. They get great reviews, awards and stuff, but there's no middle. There's no like shows that get 3 or 4 million viewers that may not be as broad as Mrs. Brown's Boys, but certainly appeal to a bit more of a range of people.
It's weird.
It sort of feels to me like that's happening. Yeah. I mean, if you wanted to be more kind of philosophical about it, I guess you could say that's happening in the world.
Yeah.
The middle class being shrunk.
You're right, yeah.
No, Uber.
God, yeah, it's a whole thing, isn't it? God, yeah.
Amazon, it's
cultural.
Like, it's either the really rich people or everyone else doing the hard work at the bottom.
I think, and it's weird with BBC, because I think that's true, but I also think specifically, like, there are shows that could be on BBC One that are on BBC Two for no good reason. So, in the Two Doors Down, are you watching that at the moment? On Friday night, Friday night, BBC
Scotland,
Two, 10 o'clock, Scottish.
Yeah, yeah.
Really good cast. Mm-hmm. Duma Kicken's in it, Arabella Weir's in it. It's got kind of gay couple character in it. Like, I can't remember the people who play them, but they're really good. Yes, I know. Shocking.
Right, that's but it. I'm complaining.
But it's actually a really well done, very mainstream comedy, just about neighbours, kind of very low concept. why it's not BBC One is mystifying. It should be on BBC One at 9 o'clock, 9.30 on a Friday night, but it's on BBC Two at 10. There's another one coming. When that finishes, there's a new show called Mum, which is Stefan Goluchowski. I think that's Goluchowski.
Him and her could have been on BBC
One. This is a really good series, Mum, with Leslie Manville. It's a bit like a kind of Mike Lee-esque thing.
Okay.
But Mike Lee films do really well. So that could be on BBC One. I just think it's fear. It seems to me like if they don't think it's got like, it's not shot in studio. Yeah, for like in the Mrs. Brown's Boy style or something, they will worry about it,
mm-hmm.
and they make sure it's only on, it's, I mean only it's make sure it's on BBC Two. But you're right, you know, it's anything on BBC Two at 10 o'clock on a Friday night, it's going to get what, a million at most.
Yeah.
Whereas BBC One, it's going to get 3-4 million maybe.
Yeah.
And it's weird that they don't.
But 3 or 4 million isn't enough. For
isn't
BBC
enough?
One,
oh
right?
My God, I know the Kennedys. So I know Emma Kennedy. You know
yeah.
Emma?
Yeah, yeah.
She did the Kennedys. I thought it was a really good, you know, strong, very likable, great
and that's,
cast.
That's the exact type of show I'm talking about. That sort.
And
of,
it was. Yeah. And it wasn't recommissioned. And it did get 3-4 million people, as far as I know.
That's a fucking lot in this day and age. What's going
it's
on?
It's incredible.
Try and put 4 million people in
absolutely.
Wembley Stadium.
Well, of
you
course,
won't.
Yeah. And you're right. And three, four million people watching a film now is a huge hit.
Yeah, that.
But on TV. At least on BBC One, who knows what their reasoning is.
I know, and I know a bunch of commissioners, and they're all good people with good taste, but when it, obviously the collective and the party line that you have to toe and stuff, you sometimes think, what is the reasoning behind stuff? I don't think I would ever get the real reason if I asked one of them individually. And I know, like I say, I know them, and I know having conversations, what great taste or diversity in taste they have. Yeah. But it just seems really, it almost feels like it's either, like we say, the really big thing and anything slightly shy of that.
Yeah,
they're too nervous to do.
I think you're right, and so what that means is that Sky now is an incredible home for comedy. So Sky is doing Julia Davis's stuff is now on Sky, Steve Coogan's stuff, Alan Partridge's show is on Sky, which was absolutely brilliant.
There's a weird one though, isn't there?
Yeah, it's weird.
I'm doing
Q&A with Steve on Wednesday next week for the new Alan Partridge one-off, which is also on Sky.
You've seen it already?
Yeah, it's great, fantastic.
Is it good?
It's brilliant.
Oh,
yeah,
God,
but I think his reasoning is why shouldn't he do? You know, to avoid Murdoch-owned things, which is what you're referring to. As a leading member of Hacked Off, etc., it's impossible, isn't it? Because you're not going to do anything for Fox,
mm-hmm.
really. You're not going to do any Fox film or TV show. You're not going to do any Sky thing. It's hard. I admire anyone who sticks to that gun of not doing anything for Murdoch. But
I think he did once, I'm sure I've heard him say, you know what, it's the press thing that I have an issue with.
Yeah, that's right, he did.
It's true. News Corp
I think I get the logic in that,
But
Sky is doing, so the Julia Davis show, did you see Camping on Sky?
Do you know what? I annoyingly don't have Sky Atlantic. You can't watch it online anywhere if you're not Now TV.
You've got to get Now TV,
I've got to get that.
Yeah,
and I know Julia really well and we've worked together
but
it's like, I just haven't been able to watch it and I keep hearing all these amazing things.
But that's the thing, that that would just have been on BBC Two, you know.
Well, I thought that about Hunderby was my favourite thing that she had done, right?
Yeah.
I loved it so much.
Yeah.
I loved it because it was also like, I sort of weirdly got caught up in the romance at the centre of it.
Of course.
Talking about the main first series.
Yes.
And I thought, well, this was a shoe-in for BBC Two, 8 years ago. Why is it on such a niche channel now?
Because they're too scared,
Camping
is equally, you get caught up in Camping, the relationships, but it's also unbelievably shockingly rude.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one thing. Yeah. I think they know Sky will let her do whatever the hell she wants in terms of that explicit content. I think BBC probably would be scared of that.
Yeah, well, I feel like that Channel 4 are doing those kinds of shows, and I'm really pleased. There's like Toast of London, there's, like you say, Catastrophe. There's another one where you say that Mum, or no, was it Two Doors Down? Very low concept. So is Catastrophe.
Yeah.
But my thing is, well, that's what happens if you give two talented writers an opportunity.
Completely.
It's not like it's, you know, I can imagine someone that isn't known pitching that idea and then going, what is this?
Yeah,
this
the genius of it, exactly, is it's Sharon Horgan and Rob Delaney.
And the execution of it.
Yeah.
Now, I was, because I don't want to just sound like a bitter old man who used to, you know, talking about the heyday of comedy, but as an experiment, right, and I am going to just sound so bitter, I thought, I'm sure there was more, not just more stuff, there definitely volume, but also like a variety of really broad, sort of middle ground, left field and stuff. So I just picked 4 years in the late 90s.
Okay.
And just looked at what was being made, and this is just some of them. This isn't even all of them, right? This is what was either being transmitted at the time or commissioned.
Yeah.
We had Father Ted, Game On, the Peter Principle. Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
With...
what's his name?
Why have I forgotten his name?
Legendary. Yeah,
oh,
guy.
My God. Jim Broadbent.
Jim Broadbent. Well done.
I love that show, and it just went completely under...
Yeah.
Peter Principle, Mrs. Merton Show, The Thin Blue Line, Mark Thomas Comedy Product, Red Dwarf was showing at the time, Roger Roger, Only Fools and Horses was showing at the time, The Armstrong and Miller Show, Chalk, Mr. Bean.
Chalk.
I'm Alan Partridge.
Talking. Yeah.
I love Chalk.
I love Chalk.
With David Bamber.
David
amazing.
Bamber's in. So, David Bamber, sorry to interrupt, but David Bamber is in camping naked. And I'm not just saying a bit naked, full frontal naked extensively.
Well, if there's.
That, what a legend.
There's an advert.
Yeah.
Stella Street, Operation Good Guys, We Know Where You Live, Brass Eye, Trigger Happy TV, that wow. Peter Kay thing.
Wow.
This Morning with Richard Not Judy, How Do You Want Me? Goodness Gracious Me, Dinner
do
Ladies.
Me?
Do you remember that one?
Vaguely.
With Dylan Moran?
Yeah, yeah. No, how do you? Of course I do, yeah.
Was it Simon Knight?
Yeah, Simon Knight. It's a great thing. It's one of my favourite things, yeah.
Smack the Pony, the 11 o'clock show, Spaced, Big
Is this
Train.
In 1 year?
This is in 4 years.
4 years, okay.
Right, so obviously that's 4 years, but have we made, like, let me finish
no,
the list.
We haven't.
Big Train, League of Gentlemen, Hippies, High Hopes, Gimme, 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 Boys Unlimited, Ali G, Alistair McGowan, Jam, Bang Bang, It's Reeves and Mortimer, Black Books, Coupling, My Family, My Hero. I mean, that's in 4 years.
Yeah, that is absolutely incredible. Yeah, you're right.
Are we making that?
No, we're not. No, it's weird, isn't it?
That is
fascinating. Yeah, I would have, that is, I mean... Trying to think.
It's a bit depressing.
Did you try
it?
And do the same thing for this from like, you know,
of course
I don't know, 2012?
I didn't, otherwise I wouldn't have, I might have lost my point.
But is that also, and they're all presumably on the main channel. So they're on BBC One, Two.
Pre-BBC Three.
Right, okay.
This is like, I think
so
I picked
just
95 to 99.
Right, right. So it's on three channels effectively because there's hardly any, nothing, there's no comedy on ITV in those days, hardly any now.
Yeah.
Apart from Benidorm. But that is unbelievable, yeah.
Which is weirdly a massive hit. So a channel that doesn't do comedy and they have one that's a massive hit, why don't?
Well.
But I wonder whether as well it's just the, obviously everything's fractured, like the way we watch stuff,
that's
see it on different things.
Yeah.
But we talk about, like, everyone sat around the telly and watched The Likely Lads or Porridge or Together.
Yeah.
Maybe some of them weren't enjoying it.
No,
they were
all
forced to watch it.
That's not true. They were like, those the classics that everyone was loving.
Yeah, of course.
But I think it is the fractured thing is key. I think, I mean, I don't know. I think maybe subconsciously, you know, the commissioners. I mean, I know, you know, the guy Shane at the BBC.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Brilliant,
yeah. and made brilliant stuff.
Yeah. So, but I do think subconsciously maybe the schedulers, because he has to. It's all very complicated. The BBC.
Yeah.
You know, you have to get things past schedulers, and you know all this, that, and the other, and the head of the BBC, whatever.
Yeah.
You've seen W1A. Like, that's what it's like. But I think.
It's like a game of risk.
It really is. But maybe they it's unconsciously going, well, Sky will do stuff with Julia Davis and Coogan, so we kind of got that covered. And do you know, maybe Netflix, you know, will give something to some other people. And you know, they just think we've got to do our own thing. And just it is the proliferation of channels globally, without want to sound like, you know, Amazon and Netflix doing their own stuff, doing more and more comedy themselves, both of them. Maybe the pressure is less on commissioners in the big channels to go, I've got to come up with, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 decent sitcoms every year and sketches. Maybe they just don't think that way because everyone else is doing stuff as
sketch
well. I don't know.
What are sketch shows?
Sketch shows, extraordinary to think,
remember
isn't
them.
It? Yeah.
That's
I mean, when looking when Victoria Wood died, just seeing repeats of As Seen on TV, unbelievable, you know, an incredible sketch show that was done week in, week out, was phenomenally good and, you know, indelible sketches, but hardly anyone's doing that.
Well, I think it's safe to say that the internet is the reason sketch shows are harder to do. Well,
maybe.
I think people would go, I could watch a sketch when I feel like it. Why am I watching somebody else's choice of 30 sketches put together? Because there was always I rewatched Fry and Laurie, which is one of my all-time favourite sketch shows. And there were some duds in there I didn't remember.
Oh, sure.
You know, I think, you know, not many, though.
No, not many. And not many on Victoria Woods either.
No.
You know, they showed a lot of them. They showed a lot of them last week, and there weren't many duds. Even the duds were, like, worth watching because she's so good in them.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Julie Walters is in it, and she's being brilliant.
People now might go, oh, I'm watching a dud. Why should I stay tuned?
Maybe you're right.
I don't know.
People, the young people, the kids, the Twitter
generation. We can't blame
everything
on the kids.
Blame something on them. But you're right, because but that does make a difference, because something, a new comedy arrives on TV and within the first 2 minutes it's being judged on
well you know
media.
All about that,
yeah, and that is different. Yeah, that is genuinely hard. Different people are horrendously horrible about new stuff arriving on, yeah. and they love hate watching stuff, and they love telling everyone on Twitter they think this is shit, don't they?
This yeah. is a theme that this is something that comes up week after week about like why people get so angry about comedy.
It's ridiculous. Yeah.
So angry.
Yeah.
Oh my
insane.
God.
Yeah.
And when I've had that awkward thing where I've made stuff that's gone out and I've caught someone who's obviously forgotten that we're both on Facebook or something saying something bad about my show.
God, that's embarrassing.
And then I see them out at an event and I'm like, do I hold, like, am I, how do I rise above this? I don't know if I'm Buddhist enough to sort of.
No, I think you should address it. You should tell them, confront it.
I'm too scared of confrontation,
okay,
Boyd.
Okay.
That's why. Anyway, do you have hope?
I do. I think, because I still think there's loads of great stuff out there. It's just not. It's not necessarily on the BBC.
Yeah.
You know, you may have to go and find it. It may be on. You need to get Sky to get Now TV to watch Julie Davis' stuff and Alan Partridge
to get my friend's stuff.
Get your friend's stuff. Yeah. It's still there, I think. You know, and Netflix. You know, Netflix. Aziz Ansari's show on Netflix. Yeah. And Kimmy Schmidt's Tina Fey series. Yeah. It's all. It's there. It's just who knows where it's going to be. But I can't imagine that. I mean, TV generally is expanding. It's the only area of the. I mean, unlike the dying of print journalism we were talking about before, TV is not. TV is like expanding phenomenally.
Yeah.
More channels, more scripted stuff than ever.
I don't know how these people afford it.
Yeah, no, I know.
You know how much. I was reading about the that book, Difficult Men. Have you read it?
Yes.
About all the drama showrunners in America. And they were talking about how they did Mad Men. It was the original show that. First original show AMC did, and the pilot cost something like $7 million. And you're like, can you imagine a network here going, let's really put everything we've got in one pilot?
Yeah.
You know,
but thank God they are wasting that money. Yeah,
I mean, drama's a whole other thing. Like that, we're in an amazing place,
incredible.
And
but I think comedy.
All my favorite stuff.
But I think that's good for comedy because I think it's not far behind. I think there'll more and more. You know, there'll be more and more new comedy because they want to get those big comedy hits as well as big drama hits. So I think I'm optimistic.
Good.
Yeah.
Oh well, that's good. We've ended on an upbeat note, Boyd. Lovely talking to you. I'd like you to come in again at some point. We can shoot the shit.
And, always available.
But we can't talk football because I know nothing about football.
That's fine. That's absolutely
and
fine.
And I know you're
it's better not to know
Arsenal
anything
fan.
About Arsenal right
now. All right.
But,
okay, good. Thank you very much, Boyd. Leading us into our next guest, this is Jim Howick's choice, first choice of two songs. This is from Indiana Jones, The Raiders of the Lost Ark, and this is The Map Room Dawn. really takes you back, doesn't it? To
it does.
Opening a...
It's a, holding a broom in the garage and pretending you're in the map room in Tannis.
Is that what you used to do?
With a... Yeah.
Did you?
We kind of acted it out in the friend's garden, and then his garage was the map room. And but he was always Indy and I was always Salah because I was younger than him and I was slightly overnourished.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have Jim Howick. James Howick? James Neil Howick,
James
of
Neil,
course.
Yeah.
I knew you were a James Neil.
Thank you. James,
he has brought his dog, which I'm excited to tell everyone is called Munson.
Yeah.
What's the reasoning behind that, Jim?
Well, Munson's named after William Hootkin's character in Flash Gordon.
I love that you know the actor's name, because I don't remember him from any other films.
He was Eckhart in Batman. He was Porkins in Star Wars. You know the guy.
He wasn't in Raiders of the Lost Ark as well, was he?
He was in Raiders of the Lost Ark. He played one of the was it CIA men?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he came to what actually was the Mason School for Girls or something in Wickham. That's where they filmed that scene on the stage. Which is one of my favourite scenes in the film. And
we're talking Flash Gordon here, right?
No, we're talking Raiders.
Oh, Raiders now. Yeah.
So the scene where he brings he gets the book out and shows them the Ark. That was filmed at the Masonic School for Girls in Wickham.
I
did a sketch with our good friend Ollie and Kevin Bishop for the Kevin Bishop Show on that stage. And it was probably the worst sketch. It didn't make the cut for Kevin's show.
Okay, well, that does tell you something,
But I remember being on the stage and looking around and going, hang on, I'm in a film.
Or, hang on, nothing's changed since I was 7 in the garage.
Yeah. Except I'm dressed as...
Except I'm getting paid for it now.
I'm dressed as a terrorist in a Channel 4 sketch show.
Wow. Well, I have to, on a very quick note, because I want to get to you, Jim. Flash Gordon was one of my favourite films as a child, to the point where, and this is probably controversial, I think I preferred it to Star Wars.
I would be... I'm close to that.
Are you? Would you support me that?
I would. I mean, I think it's funny. Star Wars, I think you're either really into Star Wars or you're not into it at all.
Well, I was into it, though. Yeah, I was really into it, but there was something about Flash Gordon.
I mean, it's so kitsch, but it's got so many great British actors in it. And Max von Sydow as well. And
so
Mike Hodges.
Fun.
And Robbie Coltrane is an extra in it.
Is he?
Yeah. So at the beginning when... Flash gets into the little sort of plane and the hail starts coming out.
Yeah.
He's the guy who sort of takes his luggage and loads it into the thing. Yeah, and closes the door. I don't know if he had a bigger part which was just cut later on.
You know your stuff, don't you?
I know my Flash.
I love it. You know, one of the facts I love is that Sam J. Jones, they asked him to dye his hair blonde and they dubbed his voice almost completely.
Really?
And you kind of think, well, maybe you should have got a different actor if you don't like his hair or his voice.
Christopher Walken.
Yeah. would have been good.
So, hang on. So they dubbed him?
Yeah.
Wow.
I think Empire or someone did the making of Flash Gordon or something, and they said that he refused to come back and dub parts of his voice, and they pretty much did all of it.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
It's weird. Love it.
Yeah.
And then when you see him in Ted, he's got this completely different...
He's got this kind of voice. He sort of sounds like a cartoon gangster or something.
Jim Howick, James Neil Howick, here we have. You will know James from the many, many TV shows he's appeared in. Peep Show, Armstrong and Miller Show, Kevin Bishop Show, Miranda, Original Perry and The Wrong Man's, Inside Number 9, loads and loads. But
probably in Miranda.
Weren't
sorry.
You?
No, I did. I did a radio pilot, which is, for some reason, it's on IMDb. I don't know.
Just goes to show how well I know that show. more recently, you have starred in the... I don't know why I'm now directing this at you, in case you've forgotten.
This is a bit like This Is Your Life.
It is, yeah. he starred in the BBC comedy Thriller, is that what you're calling it? Stag?
I think that's fair.
And the E4 sci-fi comedy drama.
Yes.
There's a multi-hyphenate there. The Aliens.
Yes.
But of course, people, I don't know how you feel about this, they're probably proud, I would imagine. People mostly know you for Horrible Histories and Yonderland.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's funny. It depends on the time of day. So in the morning, if people come up to you, it's usually about horrible histories.
Yeah.
But if you're at a festival or something, it's nearly always Peep Show.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And you're at festivals every other weekend?
Every festival there is.
And fuck, there's a lot now, aren't there? Oh, my God.
There's too many, frankly.
There are too many. That's a whole other conversation. But, yeah, that's a good place to start because you... I know this is a slightly controversial question, but I think it's fair to say that for an actor or a comedian, there is maybe a bit of a... stigma or maybe a tiny bit of reticence about doing children's television. But your show, the reason it's so successful is because it isn't really like a children's TV show. It appeals to adults, it's funny, it's smart. But was there at the very beginning when you decided to do it, were you like, oh, I'm doing a kids TV show here?
I think so. I think if the books didn't have such a wide... And use my finger to an otter, a beaver.
I don't know.
Let's say an otter.
Yeah. Okay. A beaver conjures different
it
images.
It does.
Yeah.
no. If the I think that it was already a popular brand, the books.
Right.
I think I'd just outgrown the books, so the books come along in the late.
Do you have to
80s
be a certain height to enjoy the?
Yeah. It's like a fairground. Right, that's strictly for kids.
Like inverted, though.
Yeah.
Too tall.
I think the fact that there was a brand attached, that's what attracted kind of adult comics. So there was myself and Simon Farnaby and Ben Wilbond and people that had already...
All the people that, by the way, I sort of started out with in the Edinburgh circuit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Ben sort of gave... Ben and Arne gave the sketch group that I was a part of our kind of break at the Canal Cafe Theatre. So I knew him and Simon I've known them for ages. And then I met the others on the set. But yeah, I definitely think so. I think I can remember actually being with Simon, and we didn't know what the show was going to be like, and we were sat in our trailer, and it was, you know, really low budget.
You still hadn't got scripts at even that stage in the trailer. You didn't know what it was going to be.
Yeah. We just didn't know what it was going to look like and how it was going to come across. So... But we just looked at each other and thought, well, no one's going to see it. It's fine.
Yeah,
it's fine. No one's going to see it, and I probably won't come back next year because I'm doing another series of Kevin's show. And
this is the Kevin Bishop show.
And it just became a phenomenon. Yeah. I think it's fair to say children's television.
I remember
being
with you when Harry Styles approached you and said, "Oh, I know you from Horrible Histories," and I was like, "Jim's made it." He's made it.
Yeah.
If one of the most famous people on the planet knows who he is, he's made it.
Yeah. And that was the same night. I think that was at the Groucho, wasn't it? And
No, we don't go there.
I'm in children's television. Florence and the Machines. Florence and the Machines came up to me as well. Yeah.
And did her machine come up as well?
Yeah, her machine. As well. It's like a kind of synthetic. It's like Bishop.
So you at what point did you realise, it's good, but this might actually sort of transcend your typical kids' TV show.
It was when we won the British Comedy Award for Best Sketch Show. So I think it was the first time since Anton Deck won with CDUK years ago.
Yeah.
This was the time when, you know, this was the first kind of children's sketch show that had ever won Best Sketch, the Best Sketch category. And that was the moment, I think, that we thought, okay, well, maybe we can make another show for later and do sort of Horrible Histories for Adults or something.
Yeah.
But then that would be awful if we did cross the line and make Horrible Histories for Adults. I mean, it would be...
By the way,
I
could probably...
And the violence.
I'd watch that show, by the way.
Well, yeah. I mean, you'd just be watching Caligula every night.
Yeah, but I also, you know, I'm not a massively well-educated guy, so I could use my history in bite-sized comedic pieces, you know?
There you go.
But with more sex and violence, of course.
Yeah. That was the moment when we realised that that this was really taking off. And and then we did a prom at the Albert Hall as well, which was...
And now there's tours where none of you guys are even in it.
No. Well, the company, the company that owned the brand, Scholastic Publishing, they gave, I think it was the Birmingham Touring Company, a massive contract, and that kind of corresponded with the time that we were on, and so we couldn't really get a live show on the road, which is a shame. And so we I don't think we do anymore, but we used to get kind of angry tweets from parents who felt let down, and I can understand that.
Yeah. Wow, what do you do about that?
Well, you just say, I'm sorry, man. It's nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
Actor for hire.
I mean, I've had people going like, you know, I've been trolled before, but not by an angry parent.
Yeah.
It Where means, were you? It,
yeah, it's £80 down in the foyer, yeah. Two crying children.
It's all Howick's fault.
Yeah.
They're going to grow up scarred.
But we, yeah. So
When did Yonderland come? Was that something they Sky approached you for, or did you pitch to them?
We thought that Horrible Histories was coming to an end, and which it hasn't. But that's another whole other story. But basically, we thought it was coming to an end, and we wanted to keep working together. That was the reason. And Sky came to us and said, "Look, you know, we'd love something. We'd love a family show." And we decided to keep the kind of the the wigs and the funny costumes, yeah. And how we can't incorporate history anymore. We had to walk away from history, but we decided to do fantasy.
We had to walk away from history. This is something that only ever exists in the now.
Yeah. So we did Kroll.
So they puppets, and also basically. They get every episode gets destroyed as soon as it's transmitted.
Yeah. It's like a kind of MI6.
Yeah. Because there's lots of puppets and creations there. Is it with Jim Henson's workshop?
It's with Baker Coogan, who creates puppets for Henson Workshop.
Okay, right. There is a connection.
So yeah.
And did you guys write the puppet characters? Did you have any say in the creation and the look of any of them? Yeah,
absolutely.
That must have been fun.
Oh, it was amazing.
Yeah.
So for about 3 months. Actually,
normally when you write a character in a script, you say, he's white or black, or he's 30s, or he's. Yeah, but now you can go, he has a really long nose and one eye,
So myself and Matt Bainson, who's in the group, we wrote a script for this series coming up that we've just finished filming, and one of the characters, one of the puppets, is a worm with two heads at either end, and it kind of pulls in different directions, and And yeah, you just conjure up these things. It's an amazing way to exercise your imagination.
Yeah.
And you spend about 2 months of the year when we're in pre-production, literally sitting with a concept artist and coming up with these plans. And obviously everything has to kind of
go through,
pull into line with the budget and everything else.
Yeah,
and the set and physical constraints. You know, the puppeteers have to be able to work these things. And we don't have a raised set either. Most puppet shows have a raised set so the puppeteers can move freely underneath you. Whereas our show is on normal earth ground.
Yeah.
So they're kind of on a sort of tandem skateboard moving around us.
That sounds really difficult.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's slow.
They must hate you.
And
all we wanted was a raised ground.
We've lost quite a few puppeteers actually over the years.
What? Well, dead?
No.
Oh my god, this show, like, you guys will go to any lengths to get your comedy on TV.
Sadly. Wow. They've had repetitive strain injury and, you know, all sorts of things. But I mean, I think this is something that puppeteers
it's not just you guys.
It's not just us guys,
Well, that's amazing. And then more recently you, as I mentioned, starred in Stag. Is it fair to say starred? You were one of the co-leads or something?
Yeah.
You were certainly, story-wise, a central character.
Yes, that's right.
That must have been a lot of fun to do. Up in the Highlands.
It was amazing. I mean, Jim.
People getting killed again.
Yeah, people getting killed
this
again.
This is the, by the way, listeners, that I'm referring to the characters, not the. Jim doesn't only work on shows where crew members are getting killed every.
Yeah. Every week. It's one of those shows. Jim Field Smith directed it and wrote it and co-wrote it and produced it. And he came to me sort of 2 years before. The script, I think, was delivered to the BBC and said, you know, this is if this happens, we'd love you to play this part. And he sent me a script, and it was ridiculous. I mean, it was like Cliffhanger for the BBC. And you know,
you mean the Stallone film?
Yes, the Stallone film. Yeah, I mean,
amazing.
It was kind of.
Were you like shit? I've got to work out for this.
I did work out kind of for it, any kind of
really?
For it. Just some core exercises.
Okay, I'm not going to make any comment on that.
it was an extremely physical script, which thankfully budget constraints meant that it had to kind of tone itself down. But it was, you know, typical Jim. He has incredible vision and he's incredibly ambitious, and he knows exactly what he wants. Was that your first part
where you were quite as central as that? Do you think?
Yeah. I think so.
Well, that must have been very flattering to just get the call.
It was amazing.
You didn't even audition, no?
No, but I would imagine there was a lot of discussion.
Yeah,
before,
of course, but still, you didn't have to fucking audition.
No.
It's amazing.
So it's incredible.
Because I don't know a single actor.
Jim and George, a tremendous amount.
I don't know a single actor who, no matter how good they are, who likes auditioning. Well, maybe some, but they're just weird.
Yeah. I don't know if this was made on the proviso that Jim was going to get sort of Benedict Cumberbatch and Tom Hardy at the time to sort of act around me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
To act around me. Not even as kind. There'd be the trees, the wind.
Just to be the elements.
Yeah, I can imagine Benedict being good as the elements.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's quite Shakespearean, isn't it?
Tempest,
to play a tree.
The Tempest itself.
Yeah.
So Jim called me up and asked me if I would be interested, and of course I would be interested. But I never thought I'd get the gig, and it turns out I did, and that's thanks to Jim.
And the show went down well.
I think so. Yeah.
Is there a way of doing a follow up?
I don't think so. No. Jim has plans to kind of do a hen do style thing,
okay.
But maybe taking it away from Scotland, so that the crew are a lot happier. Balham, maybe, or Chichester.
Yeah, where a lot of people die.
Where a lot of people do die. They go to die.
And then the aliens, which I have to, I'm sorry to say, I haven't actually seen
That's
yet.
Okay.
I mean, you're in so many things. I've got a lot of catching up to do.
Well, there's two.
I'm talking about your entire breadth of work here.
Sure. The Aliens. So that's a Earth-based sci-fi.
Mm-hmm. You know that genre, Earth-based sci-fi.
Earth-based sci-fi.
Yeah.
Cocoon.
Mm-hmm.
So basically,
by the way, never pitch this show again. Because I have no idea what you're talking about now.
Okay, so aliens arrived on our planet in the 70s. Mm-hmm. They crash landed, and they're
The 70s
they're
have got a lot to
I
answer
know, haven't
for,
they?
Haven't they?
Yeah, I know. The Golden Age. And they were brought out, and then they were ghettoized. So basically, the story is that the aliens are ghettoized, and the central character is played by Michael Socker, who plays a border guard on this kind of... wall, so to speak. It's called The Wall. And the aliens are sort of tagged and let through, and in the middle of the ghetto there's a crime syndicate which is kind of imposed and encouraged by the human side in order to keep in sort of illegitimate order over there, and what it basically turns into a big gang warfare crime thing.
Is it
exciting?
It looks great. And is it a when I looked on the Wikipedia, it said comedy drama. Is it comedic in part?
Yes. I mean, I think that's kind of my role in it, really, is I'm one of the sort of the comedy...
You're like relief.
The relief, yeah. Yeah. Because it is quite violent.
Yeah, and also it's
kind of Tarantino-y in its tone.
Okay.
And it's kind of accidental violence, which I always think is the most brutal violence. Mm-hmm. So... For example, the moment in Pulp Fiction where the kid gets shot by accident. I mean, that's horrendous.
Spoiler!
Sorry, guys.
There's still a lot of people that haven't seen that.
You can swear. The kid dies in the car, right? That's terrible.
He gets shot in the fucking face.
There's a lot of cars, and there's a lot of death, there's a lot of kids. Yeah, so, and you know, things like that. Things like City of God and Tarantino, and things where
and it's all good, great references. I really want to see it now. And it's dealing with big themes, obviously, like kind of immigration and segregation and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's dealing with themes that aren't just current. You know, these are themes that have been around for... Four or five years. and 40.
Since the beginning of time, I would say.
Since the beginning of time.
There was a lot of tension between the humans and the
There's
dinosaurs.
Exactly.
Even though they didn't exist at the same time.
And that's what Jurassic Park...
Yeah,
you can see what happens
there. It's a nightmare. Well, great. Is that a show that that could come back if they wanted to come back?
It could do. I mean, we haven't heard anything else, but we filmed it in Bulgaria, so it's quite difficult to film over there because the weather's reasonably extreme. reasonably extreme. Mm. That's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's extreme. Mm-hmm. So if you film in sort of late September, it's in the 40s because it's next door to Greece.
Yeah.
And if you film in December, it's kind of snow up to your knees.
Yeah,
so you've got 3 months to
shoot
basically.
Plebs there.
Yeah, at the same time.
I've heard all the same. Yeah. And actually, you can see it in the show sometimes, the cold breath, yeah. and they're all like clearly in their minds going, why the fuck did I sign up to this?
But they're all in they're in tunics as well, which doesn't help.
No, it doesn't help at all. Yeah. So we haven't got long to. No. I could chat to you for much longer, James Neil. But we need to get to your guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
Because on this show, we ask people to put forward their guilty pleasure.
I've brought sort of points with me.
Oh, excellent.
So this might speed things along.
Okay, great. Well, should we just do this in a bullet point?
Should we just do this now? Yeah, so
well, tell the viewers, listeners, what your guilty pleasure is.
My guilty pleasure is A View to a Kill, the 1985 Roger Moore Bond film.
Mm-hmm. You actually asked me in a text message whether it was... What was it you said? Is it obscure or is it guilty enough or something?
Well, it's...
I think in the world, if we're talking about Bond films, it's definitely a guilty pleasure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because people will
it's widely
come
considered
on.
One of the worst Bond films.
Isn't Octopussy considered
I
the
think
worst?
So. Yeah. I mean, that's just outright racism in places. But it's...
And you can't say that's a guilty pleasure.
No. But you get to a certain age, I think, and guilty pleasures are no longer guilty. I think you just think, I'm going to watch what I want.
Oh, the irony is completely worn off.
Absolutely.
I like it.
And you enjoy the irony. Yeah. It's, you know...
What do you love about it so much?
Well, it's courageous. And there's so much to love about it. Firstly, I'm going to start with this, because I think this is possibly one of the greatest Bond moments. Bond makes a quiche.
Oh, my God.
In this film.
This is amazing.
I'm not talking about warming up a quiche. He makes it from scratch. And it's the most...
He can do anything.
He can do anything. It's the most... Roger Moore-y quiche as well. It's a quiche de cabernet. Which I've never heard. I've never heard. Yeah, he says it in the script. He says, et voilà, quiche de cabernet. Which is...
Does that mean it's got wine in it or something?
I don't know.
What does that mean?
Well, on the top, it's got peppers and olives on it. Okay. And a little sort of 70s. Yeah. It looks very 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though it's in the 80s. He makes a quiche de cabernet from scratch, and then they sit and eat it, and they talk. It's basically an exposition tool. But they've missed the trick here, because surely the most exciting exposition tool is making the quiche de cabernet. He would have had to make the short crust.
Yeah.
He would have had to...
Well, I remember this bit. We just cut to... I've actually even spoken to other people about this bit. I love it so much.
Yeah.
We just cut to, like, later, and he's revealing a perfectly made quiche.
Quiche de cabernet.
With still all the normal Bond clothes that he wore in that era, and no mess anywhere.
No mess, no flour.
No flour.
Anywhere.
Because he is that fucking good.
He's that good. I mean, when you think about, you know, Daniel Craig would probably make a stew, wouldn't he? He'd make something long,
or
something
a curry.
One pot.
Yeah.
You know,
something that he could leave overnight.
I don't like to waste a stew.
Yeah.
View.
Yeah.
Skyfall.
very good. You could do it. You could go on the comedy circuit with that.
Thanks. Yeah. Well. Yeah. But yeah. So okay. So that's the kickoff. We've got that happens in the middle of the film.
I hope that isn't the only reason, because really it sounds like you just want to watch cookery shows.
So Christopher Walken plays the villain, which is probably one of the greatest Bond villain casting of the last. 30, no, hang on, the last 10 Bond films, say. Mm-hmm. Maybe. He's good. Let's just say he's really good.
Okay, he's good.
He's good. But Bond, the henchman, is Grace Jones. She's the henchman.
Henchwoman,
sorry.
I don't know what the correct...
Henchwoman.
Henchperson.
Yeah, henchperson, yeah. Hench.
Hencher.
Hencher.
Yeah.
The hencher is fashion icon and pop star... Grace Jones. So there's that, right?
Yeah, which
and I heard that Bowie and Sting, in that order, were offered the part, Walken's part, before Walken.
Well, that would have been interesting. Bowie and Grace Jones as sort of new romantic villains.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that they must have had Grace Jones in place before Bowie turned it down. Whatever, they were going for someone blonde.
Yeah, right, okay.
It was Bowie.
They still didn't get him because he had to dye his hair.
They still didn't get him. So you've got Walken. Yeah. So at the beginning, right, so Bond's, you know, messing around in the snow looking for microchips, and you've got Barry's score, and then all of a sudden the Beach Boys come in. California
I was
girls.
Rewatching it last night. I was like, I'm not sure how I feel about this.
It's weird.
It's so, like, so I get what they're trying to do.
And it's a cover of, it's a cover, it's not even them.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, that's kind of, that's weird. It has the best Bond song. We've just discussed this and we were talking about it.
Well, Blade. Maybe not the best one.
One of them.
But one, I think, an underrated one. There you go. That's what I'm going to say. Yeah. An underrated Bond song. Bond song.
Okay, so it's got that. So
you're just chucking anything at me here. Can I just say, when I was rewatching it last night, it really struck me, and maybe that's because we've now got used to the Daniel Craig Bond, it really struck me what a pervy old man Roger Moore is.
Yeah.
I mean, A, in this film, he's like in his early 60s or something.
He's 58.
58, there you go.
So he's 10 years older than Craig is now.
But 50, like, and the women that he's sleeping with are all in their like late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's never any question of like whether he's, what he's doing. It stinks of...
I think that's what it's become. I think at the time,
it's all a,
we didn't, I didn't really consider it.
No, like, of course
my
not.
Dad did, because Bond was probably about 3 years younger than my granddad.
Yeah.
When I watched it for the first time, which is weird. So it's kind of, the film itself has almost turned into a bit of a freak show.
Well, and also, whenever, and the sort of disparity between... when he's, they do a close up of him on, say, on the ski slope, and then cut into his body double,
is
so ridiculous now that it's like, well, I just know that isn't Roger Moore.
Of course, it can't be. There's a moment where he's driving this Renault, and the windscreen gets sliced off by a barrier,
mm-hmm.
and the double sort of pops up, and it looks like my dad. Well, no, it doesn't look like my dad, because my dad's Roger Moore's age now. It looks like a man our age. And someone's just like plopped a handful of hay on this man's head, and as like a kind of weird Roger Moore.
I mean, there is also, and maybe this is why you've picked it as a guilty pleasure, but there is also something of a something quite sweet about it as well. You know, there's something sweet about the weird pervy old man.
I mean, fair play to him. He's doing things that I couldn't do now.
But do you love, just to wrap up, because we do have to finish
this
set.
Yeah.
But do you feel like modern Bond films have lost some of that fun, or are you one of those people, you sort of hark back to them more, or do you think that was of its time and we can't really go back to it?
I do think it's of its time. I do. Yeah. I think it has. I think the reason why I look at those Bond films with such affection is because they're so appealing to kids. Everything's kind of goofy and big, mm-hmm. and ridiculous. And I was very excited when Daniel Craig came back and we entered a kind of serious, more sort of Cold War-y style Bond.
But you would like some a few more jokes again.
I do enjoy a bit of cheeky humour.
Yeah. Jim, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks, man.
Why don't you tell everyone what your second choice of music is? This is a song, in fact, I think.
Yeah.
Is it a song? Do you call
it? It is a song, yeah. It's a Kenny Rogers song. It's just popped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Mm-hmm. And
from,
this is from
the Big Lebowski.
The Big Lebowski. Yeah. No connection to anything we've spoken about
Nothing
today.
Nothing at all.
But this is a particular favourite of yours.
I love it. I first heard it, Supergrass did a cover of it on TFI Friday in the 90s. And
and you've loved it ever since.
I've loved it ever since, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, man.
Goodbye.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in. I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky. I just dropped in see what condition my condition was in.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I pushed my soul in a deep dark hole and then I followed it in. I watched myself crawling out as I was crawling in. I got up so tight I couldn't unwind. I saw so much I broke my mind. I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in. black letters on a dead end sign. I had my foot on the gas as I left the road and blew out my